What then did my Sakme take Joseph for? For something right and proper. For the right and expected one. For the bringer of the new time. At first, only in the limited sense that this man, convicted of an interesting crime, and sent down to the humdrum hole where it had been the captain's lot to do service for years, and who knew how much longer, brought with him a definite break in the monotony. But when the commandant of Zawi Ray so sharply condemned and rejected any confusion between phrase and reality, his strictness may have sprung from his own involvement in that very confusion. Indeed, if he did not take care, he might actually find himself guilty of mixing up the literal and the figurative. In other words, such faint stirrings, associations, intuitions, as Joseph's traits called up, were enough to make the governor round them out into full reality, which in Joseph's case meant the manifestation of the expected one, the bringer of salvation who comes to end the reign of the old and monotonous and to usher in a new epoch amid the rejoicing of all humanity. But about this figure which Joseph suggested floated the nimbus of the divine, and in that, again, is inherent the temptation to mix up the metaphorical and the actual, the quality with that from which the quality is derived. But is that such a misguided temptation? Where the divine is, there is God. There is, as my Sakme would have put it, if he ever did put anything instead of divining and believing it, a God, in the disguise, of course, which outwardly and indeed mentally is to be respected, even though as a disguise it shows through, so to speak, and is not very convincing, because it is itself so very lovely and well-favored. My Sakme could not have been a child of the black earth without knowing that there are images of God, breathing images of the deity, which must be distinguished from the inanimate ones and honored as living images of God, like Hapi the bull of Menphe, and like Pharaoh himself in the horizon of his palace. The governor's knowledge of this fact did contribute not a little to shape his speculations about Joseph's nature and appearance, and we know, of course, that for his part, Joseph was not precisely keen on checking such speculations, but on the contrary, rather enjoyed making people sit up. For the office and the bookkeeping, Joseph's presence was a perfect blessing. Tradition wrongs the captain when it says he took nothing on himself. But it was true that the office routine, so important in the eyes of his superiors in Thebes, had, as he well knew, been neglected for the pursuit of his tranquil passions of medicine and literature. Even his official reputation had already suffered on occasion, and letters full of polite, roundabout unpleasantness had come from the capital. And here Joseph proved to be the long-desired indeed, the bringer of change, the man of the I Am He. He put all the records in order, taught my Sakme's scribes, much given to Mora and Skittles, that the higher preoccupations of their head were no reason why they should let dust accumulate on the necessary business of the place, but on the contrary were every ground for their own added diligence. Joseph saw to it that regular reports and accounts went off to the capital, where the authorities read them with pleasure. In his hand, the staff of office became a cobra snake stiffened to a magic wand. He needed only to tap a vat with it to say offhand, "That will hold 50 sacks of wheat." And when they needed to know how many bricks it would take to build a ramp, he would put the staff to his forehead and then say, "It will take 5,000 bricks. The first time, that had been exactly right. The next time, not quite. But when he was quite right the first time, the success gilded the faultiness of the second guess and made that correct, too. In short, Joseph had not betrayed the captain in saying, "I am he." And when the bookkeeping and the housekeeping came to no harm, my Sakme often required his presence in the tower as well, where he compounded his drugs and made his literary essays. He liked to have Joseph about him, to discuss such matters as the correct number of blood vessels, and whether worms were the cause or the effect of disease. He set him to copy out the tale of the two brothers, just as Joseph had done for his former master, in the deluxe edition on fine papyrus with red and black ink. My Sakme found his assistant just the man for the job, not only because he could write a calligraphic script, but also because the subject matter was allied to Joseph's own fate. It was especially as a fool for love that my Sakme found him so interesting. It was a field in which the governor's sympathies were warmly, if sedately, engaged, as indeed it is the chief theater for the most fascinating exercise of the literary art. We can see how much time Jacob's son had to take from his administrative tasks, without neglecting them, to devote to my Sakme's private avocations. They conferred for hours at a stretch how best to begin to commit to paper, in a pleasing, if possible even exciting, not to say thrilling style, the story of the governor's 3-in-1 love affair, which was still, in part, a tale of expectancy. The greatest and most discussed difficulty was this. If you included the third episode by anticipation, you would have to write the whole thing from the point of view of an old man of at least 60, and that, they feared, would detract from the thrillingness, which, even as it was bound to suffer from the governor's natural temperament. Then there was Joseph's own adventure, which had brought him down to the prison. His affair with the Sun courtier's wife profoundly engaged my Sakme's literary sympathies, and Joseph told him the whole story, taking care, of course, to spare the afflicted woman and not to minimize his own sins. These he described as being of the same nature as the ones he had earlier been guilty of against his own brothers, and so against his father, the shepherd king. So, step by step, he was brought back to the tale of his youth and origins. The captain's shrewd brown eyes got a strange and pregnant, dissolving view into the backgrounds of this phenomenon, his aide, the convict Osarsif. My Sakme liked the fantastic name, obviously a made-up, elusive combination. He spoke it feelingly, like the good man he was, never taking it for the newcomer's own, but rather for a disguise, or an epithet, or a circumlocution of the I am he. He would have liked, with the enthusiasm of the born storyteller, to put to paper the tale of Potiphar's wife, and often he diverted himself with discussion about the best method. But when he tried, the result turned out to follow the pattern of the two brothers, and he presently left off where he began. The days went on. They multiplied. Soon, almost a year had gone round since Rachel's firstborn came to Zawi Ray. Then there befell something in the prison, part of a series of important events in the great world. Not immediately, but after some lapse of time, this happening in the prison was to have extraordinary results and produce great changes for Joseph and for his friend and taskmaster, my Sakme. The Two Fine Gentlemen. One day, that is, Joseph betook himself at his usual early hour to the governor's tower, with some business papers for his chief's approval. The scene was always much like what happened between Petipre and the old steward Montcaw, and had the same ending. Very good, my friend. This time my Sakme did not even look at the accounts, waving them away with his hand. His brows were even higher than usual, his lips more parted. It was plain that he was taken up with a particular occurrence, and, within the limits of his phlegm, wrought up. "Another time, Osarsif," he said, referring to the papers. "Now is not the moment. Let me tell you, in my prison things are not as they were yesterday and the day before. Something has happened. It happened before daybreak, very quietly, under special and secret orders. There has been a delivery of prisoners, a most embarrassing one. Two persons have arrived under cover of darkness for temporary arrest and safekeeping. Not ordinary persons. I mean, they are very highly placed, or they were, and may be again. But just now they have come down in the world. You have taken a fall yourself, but theirs is worse because they stood much higher. Listen while I tell you, but better not ask for details." "But who are they?" asked Joseph all the same. "Their names are Mesedsu Ray and Bin Emwese," answered the governor with reserve. "Hark to that," cried Joseph. "What sort of names are those? People don't have such names. He had good ground for surprise, for Mesedsu Rei meant hateful to the sun god, and Bin Emwese, evil in Thebes. Those would have been strange parents who gave their son such names. The captain mulled about with some sort of decoction without looking at Joseph. I thought, he said, you knew that people are not necessarily named what they call themselves or are temporarily called. Circumstances can make names. Rei himself changes his according to his circumstances. These gentlemen are called as I have called them, in their papers and the orders I received about them. Those are their names in the minutes of the action which will be brought against them, and they call themselves so according to their circumstances. You will not want to know more about it than that. Joseph quickly considered. He thought of the revolving sphere, of the above that becomes below, and again mounts upwards by turns, of the laws of opposites, of how order is reversed and things turned upside down. Hateful to the sun god, that was Mersu Rei. The Lord loves him. Evil in Thebes, that was good in Thebes, Nefer Emwese. Through Potiphar, he knew much about Pharaoh's court and the friends of the palace Merimat, and he recalled that Mersu Rei and Nefer Emwese were the names, quite overlaid with fulsome honorary titles, of Pharaoh's chief baker and supervisor of sweetmeats, with the title of Prince of Menphe, and of his overseer and scribe of the buffet, the head butler, Count of Abodu. The real names, said he, of these given into your hands, are probably, what does my lord eat, and what does my lord drink? Well, yes, responded the captain. One only needs to give you an inch and you have an L, as the saying goes, or you think you have. Know what you know, and ask no further. What can have happened? Asked Joseph, notwithstanding. Let be, replied Maisakme. They say, he went on, looking in the other direction, that pieces of chalk were found in Pharaoh's bread, and flies in the good god's wine. How such responsible dignitaries came to be accused of such things, and be sent up here awaiting investigation, under names corresponding to their circumstances, you can figure that out yourself. Chalk? Repeated Joseph. Flies? Before daylight, went on the captain, they were put under strong guard on a boat bearing the sign of suspicion on prow and sail. They have been given me into strict, though also suitable, safekeeping till their trial, until the verdict is pronounced. A most responsible and trying business. I have put them into the little vulture hut, you know, around the corner to the right by the back wall, that has a vulture with outspread wings on the ridgepole. It happened to be vacant, or rather empty, for it is not furnished in the least as they are used to. And there they sit since early this morning with some bitter beer, each of them on an ordinary camp stool, and the vulture house has no other amenities whatever. It is pretty hard on them. And what will be the end of their affair? Whether they will soon be put in corpse color, or whether the majesty of the good God will lift up their heads again, nobody can say. We have to behave in the light of this uncertainty, taking account within limits of their former station and to the extent of our powers. I will put you in charge of them. You will visit them twice or thrice a day, you know, and ask after their wants, if only for form's sake. Such gentlemen require good form. If we only ask what they would like, it does them some good, and it is less important after that whether they get it. You have the society graces, the savoir-faire, he said. He used an Akkadian expression. You can talk with them in a way that suits their own elegant conventions and their present circumstances, too. My lieutenants here would be either too rough or too subservient. We have to keep the right balance. Respect with a shade of solemnity. That would be about my idea. I'm not so good at solemnity, said Joseph. It is not my long suit. Perhaps I might make the respectfulness a little ironic, just slightly mocking.
That might be good, too, the captain responded. When you inquire after their wishes, they see at once that you are not serious, and that, of course, they can't have things here the way they are used to them, or only sort of symbolically, as it were. Anyhow, we cannot have them squatting there in an empty hut. We must put in two beds with headrests, and at least one comfortable chair, if not two, with cushions for the feet. They can take turns sitting in it. And you must act as their vizier. What would my lord eat? And their vizier, what would my lord drink? And go a little way towards satisfying their wishes. Say they want roast goose, you can give them stork. If they ask for cake, you can give them shortbread. If they want wine, let them have grape juice. We will try every time to go halfway, and at least show our willingness on all occasions. Go along now and pay them your respects, with any kind of coloring you think best. Beginning tomorrow, you should go morning and evening.